focused on engineering in order to widely instill this ethic. Note that I say fact-driven, not data-driven. There's been something of a deification of data in recent years, as though data itself is the answer, the ultimate truth. There's a dangerous fallacy that data constitutes the facts you need to know to run your business. Hard data is absolutely vital, of course, but you also need qualitative insights and well-formulated opinions. And you need your team to debate those insights and opinions openly and with gusto. Data doesn't have an opinion. I loved when we hired somebody new in data science, especially in the early days. We'd all had our own beliefs about customer behaviors that they'd bust. In the beginning, we opined about how the customer behaved based on ourselves as customers. We would argue back and forth saying, that's not the way they watch. No, I don't watch that way. And then with the transition to streaming, we started to get actual viewing data. Before that, we'd only known which DVDs we shipped to people and what they put in their queues. The now all but forgotten feature, allowing people to line up as many items as they wanted, to be sent to them as soon as the DVDs were back in stock. Now, all of a sudden, we could see which content was actually watched most avidly. Who knew people were so crazy about shows like Storage Wars and Swamp People? The rush of data dispelled many of our old myths. Data is great. Data is powerful. I love data. But the problem is people become overly wedded to data and too often consider it too much too narrowly, removed from the wider business context. They consider it the answer rather than the basis of good questions. I love the distinction Ted Sarandos made to me about how data is best used. He said that the decision-making of his content team is data-informed rather than data-driven. When Netflix launched House of Cards, lots of attention was given to how Ted's team had done such a deft job of mining Netflix viewership data. They concluded the show would be a good fit, in part because the show's star was popular with viewers, as was another drama set in the halls of Washington Power, The West Wing. In reality, while the data gave us a great assist, a huge part of the decision to go with the show was that the remarkably talented David Fincher was developing it. Ted stresses that insights from data analysis complement his team's decision-making, but certainly don't dictate it. They've seen that a project can fail, even with all sorts of supporting data. Whether to move forward with a show or film is very much a judgment call. When the team decided to go ahead with Orange is the New Black, they overrode their mandate that shows had to have well-developed scripts. Not because the data was telling them the show would be a hit, but because the brilliant vision of the show's creator, Genji Kohan, which was brilliantly thought out. The show is based on a book, and others wanted to develop it for the screen. But there were worries that the viewers wouldn't be sympathetic to the prisoners, and that a prison might be a claustrophobic setting. Kohan planned to expand the storytelling to take viewers into the inmates' lives before they were sent to prison. Doing so would show that so many of the women who end up in such low-security prisons, as the author of the book did, are far from hardened criminals, making them more sympathetic and engaging viewers in their life stories. The content team has been regularly surprised by responses to original programming, with some shows being much stronger draws than expected, and others being the reverse. They might take that viewer response data not as an endpoint in deciding how to proceed with the show, but as a launching point for interrogating their understanding of the response. If a show falls flat, they ask whether that was due to a creative failing, or was it a matter of marketing or positioning. Ted also pointed out that viewership data can be limited in its ability to provide information about what people would like to watch if they could. When Netflix began planning to go global, the conventional wisdom about what international viewers wanted to watch was skewed by global box office data. The data seemed to suggest that overseas viewers weren't that interested in a number of American shows. What the data couldn't factor in was that people in many countries had very limited access to American programming. When Netflix made so much of that programming available for the first time across the board, people flocked to it. Ted said of his team's content creation process, "There is lots of intuition that's acted on, and I look for people for the team who are smart enough to read the data and intuitive enough to know how to ignore it." Ted also cautions that data can be used as an accountability shield, deflecting the responsibility for a judgment call. People are more comfortable making decisions based on hard data, in part because they can fall back on that data if the decision turns out to be wrong. Television series pilots are a great case in point. Because they are tested with viewers, if a show ultimately fails, the production team can always say, "Well, it tested really well." Ted's team hasn't followed the pilot model. They greenlight production of a whole season at once. People can also be biased about which data they marshal. And we've seen that people tend to privilege their own data over that of others. Marketing hauls out one set of data and sales another. Data is only one component of problem solving. Even if everyone across all teams has all the same data, you need people to challenge one another about aspects of the business that no spreadsheet can speak to. Beware of data that looks great, but doesn't matter. Because software engineers know that I like them, they constantly approach me to take a look at their new products. One wanted me to review his fancy new HR management software. He completely filled the whiteboard with the product map of the software, an elaborate system waterfalling goals down from upper management to individual contributors. All that data was entered into software, and then there was an extraordinarily intense employee assessment that took 2 hours, with a facilitator for each individual, in order to populate all the data fields for a giant relational database. I stopped him and said, "Can I say something? Can I stop you right there? So I need to hire somebody from your firm to sit down with each of my employees for 2 hours to fill out this form." It was online, but it was essentially a form. "And with the roll-up of all these goals, it's going to spit out an algorithm, and it's going to give me what?" And he said, "Well, HR will finally have data." So I asked him, "What will they do with this data?" He answered, "Well, they'll finally have it." Can I say, "What? Why should anyone spend so much time and money just to create data?" One of the biggest mistakes is fixating on metrics that don't matter. Take HR and its obsession with retention. HR is the department that's supposed to take care of people's well-being, and supposedly the key metric to measuring that is retention. Yet 50% of what HR does is say goodbye to people. I was consulting to an executive team recently, and their head of HR told me that they're concerned about keeping people because everyone will leave for a better perk or more money. I ask, "How do you know that's true?" In my experience, the best people are not swayed by perks, but I also question whether turnover is really such a big problem. It depends on the context. If you're working on a project that's heads down, 3 or 4 year job that requires a lot of people putting in a lot of effort, and the training and assimilation cycle is very long, then you definitely want people to stay engaged for that time. But even so, the way to keep employees committed is to hire people who are really interested in a problem like the one you're hiring for, and who have a track record or a proclivity for working on things for a very long time. It's not to offer them four kinds of flavored water and sleeping pods. Often companies have much shorter term needs, and when a task has been completed, it's best for both the company and the employees if you tell them it's time to look for a new job, about which more later. Another big mistake made with metrics is thinking that they're fixed. They must be fluid. They must be continuously revisited and questioned. This is where vigorous debate comes in. Debate only for the sake of the business and customers. While our debates at Netflix often got heated, they generally didn't become mean-spirited or counterproductive, because we set a standard that they should all essentially be about serving the business and our customers. One of the worst ways that companies fail to serve their customers, and therefore their own profitability, is neglecting to interrogate intensively enough what the data is really telling them. Often a business must choose between two alternatives for catering to customer needs and preferences, both of which have strong data-backed arguments behind them. Making these calls requires judgment to complement the data. A great mechanism we created for keeping the focus on the customers and ensuring we rigorously and openly debated such difficult judgment calls was a monthly forum, the Consumer Science Meeting. The name was a riff on computer science, a way of saying that while we were absolutely an innovator of data-intensive analytics, our computing was all in the service of pleasing customers. Reed and our heads of marketing and product always attended, and members of the content team often came up from LA. I almost always went because it was a fantastically informative meeting that kept me up to speed with the leading edge of business development. The purpose of the meeting was to present the results of all the consumer tests we'd done the previous months and the arguments for those planned for the current month. The employees who had devised and run the tests made the presentations, and the executive's role was to intensely question them about the results and their rationales for the upcoming tests. One of those often in the hot seat was Steve McClendon, who had started at the company in print marketing and been promoted into many roles in the marketing group that involved testing. Ultimately, he had moved over to the product group as a director of product innovation, an extraordinary accomplishment. Steve is quick to say that he was something of a fish out of water when he joined Netflix. He had no prior experience with anything like the intensity of our business. He had been selling ad space for a small print periodical in Santa Cruz, and he was originally in charge of placing our print ads, a positively archaic business compared with the booming frontier of online targeting. Steve is also a naturally laid-back guy. I was curious to hear his reflections on facing the barrage of questioning in the consumer science meeting, and he made no bones about how stressful it could be. But his main point was that you learn how to come in and think about questions in a structured way, anticipate the kind of questions you're going to get, and have your argument as buttoned up as you can. He said that because both marketing and product heads were present, he also learned to think much better from both perspectives. Every intense disagreement we had about serving customers better found its way into the consumer science meeting. Our debates there underscored that no one, no matter how experienced or high level, could fully understand our customer needs and desires purely on the basis of their experience or brilliance. We often went into tests with sharp divisions in our expectations about the results. One of the most heated of these concerned the queue feature. Our data clearly showed that customers loved the queue. It was a big brand builder and a driver of customer loyalty. But once we moved to streaming, we no longer needed the queue. Everyone who wanted to could stream the same content all at once. Should we do away with the beloved queue? Views were strongly divided. We took the debate to the data. Customer surveys showed that a relatively small segment were adamantly opposed to doing away with the queue. But A/B tests showed that it made no material difference in customer retention or the number of movies or shows watched or any of the hard-driven measures of customer satisfaction. We decided to do away with it because doing so would free up system capability for enhancing the quality of our streaming. After some initial vocal protests from the minority of ardent fans, the change was embraced. Steve McClendon reminded me of another such counterintuitive test result, this one around the customer sign-in process. The findings floored him. We were constantly running tests on the process, but this was a particularly controversial one. The hypothesis was that we could boost the number of people who signed up for a free trial and then ultimately subscribed if we removed the friction from the initial sign-up by not requiring people to input their credit card information. Steve was adamant that subscriptions would dramatically increase, and yet the results were abysmal. They plummeted by half. He was so stunned that he really wanted to run the test again. Debating the result, we realized that, ironically, in trying to remove friction, we had introduced more by effectively forcing people to go through a sign-up process twice. Earn a reputation for selflessness. Executives tell me all the time about virtual wars raging between department heads. They can't conceive of the possibility of conducting an open debate about core business issues without it escalating into counterproductive dispute, even internecine battle. Well, it's true that if you and I disagree about something and have a knockdown, drag-out fight about it, and I think you're fighting for your ego or your department or your pet idea, then I'm going to think of a clever way around it to get around you. But if I believe you're fighting for the good of the company, defined as doing the right thing for the customer, then I'll be more willing to hear you. In the consumer science meeting, as in human nature, often enough people would go off on a tear, slipping into argument for argument's sake. But someone would always interject, "And how does this help the customer exactly?" Diversion averted. Another way of establishing that you're being selfless in your advocacy is to avidly recognize the problem-solving contributions of others. Reed again modeled this well. John Cincuti recalled a particularly telling case. One of the reasons we needed the queue in the DVD days was that managing the inventory and getting the discs to customers quickly was an incredibly difficult task. We had millions of movies coming in and out each day, and we were shipping more items than Amazon was. And of course, we had to create the capacity not only to ship them out, but to get them back, and then to ship them out quickly again. A particular problem was that certain titles tended to disproportionately accumulate at different distribution centers. And John proposed an idea for a way to solve the problem. "I had a theory of why the accumulations were happening," he recalled, "and I pushed it a couple of times and I didn't get pickup on it. We tried everything else, and then in a meeting long time later, Reed threw up his hands in desperation and said, 'Well, let's try Cincuti's idea.' I looked up and said, 'What idea?' I had actually forgotten about it. But Reed remembered. The team tried it out and it worked." Reed had listened carefully enough to John's idea that he had internalized it and could actually recall it after its originator had forgotten about it. As John said, "That's the kind of respect he would give you. He was listening to this idea that nobody thought was a good one." That story also highlights that even with avid, selfless debate, good ideas will sometimes get shot down, which is another reason it's so important that people recognize that even the most compelling fact-based arguments can be wrong, and that fact-based does not equal true. It also underscores the importance of revisiting conclusions. Quite often, conclusions we'd thought we'd debated to death had to be revisited and debated all over again. Orchestrate the debates you want. At one point, a big disagreement arose between Netflix's head of marketing and head of content concerning how we thought about our customers. It was developing into a real tussle because both executives were very strong-minded and both had good reasons for their views. Reed did a beautiful thing. He arranged a debate between the two, on stage, in chairs facing each other, in front of the rest of the executive team. And the really brilliant twist was that each one had to argue the other's side. To prep for that, they had to really get into the other person's skin. Reed made this style of formal debate a regular practice for the product development team. Once a month, he'd hold a meeting in the Netflix theater with everybody sitting on benches in a forum style. He would ask a few people in advance to be prepared to argue different sides of an issue. Eric Colson recalled to me, "These were really well-argued cases, and we'd be sitting there thinking, 'Yeah, we should do that.' And then Reed would say, 'Okay, so-and-so, what's the counter-argument?' And then we'd nod along with that person thinking, 'Yeah, we should definitely do that.'" You learn the tough issues are never one-sided. In that meeting, the team would also break out into small groups of three or four to debate approaches to a problem and then present their solutions. Any domain specialists in the topic to be debated would be spread around so as to not unduly sway opinion or cause others to hold back. Breaking into smaller groups had multiple benefits. It cut down on groupthink that tends to prevail in larger groups, and it forced everyone to speak up because in such a small group, hanging back and staying silent is glaringly conspicuous. It also allowed people from different working groups to get to know each other's personalities and ways of thinking. Additionally, it helped counteract the danger of expertise. As Eric said to me, the downside of experts is that they are all too aware of the current constraints. Someone with fresh eyes can sometimes find their way around constraints almost out of ignorance. You can orchestrate great conversations if you take a little time to set them upright and make it clear that everyone's seeking the best answer for the customer and the company, that no one is arguing simply to win. The way to do that is to set the context, to be clear about what the group is going to decide, and the reason for the conversation. If the conversation digresses, or if someone is stubbornly digging in, you can always interject, "What problem are we trying to solve here? or what leads you to believe that's true. One of the best ways of ensuring that debates adhere to those standards and stay civil is to stage them in front of a group. So often, executives keep their disagreements among themselves, yet those differences of opinion might be the most important things for those below the executive level to understand and weigh in on. Staging formal debates also models how good debating is done. Of course, this can be hard for people. They're often going to lose the day, and that's hard for anyone to do in front of a crowd, let alone really smart people, who are extremely talented at problem-solving and marshaling facts. But over time, everyone comes to appreciate that they always come out alive, and usually the best decision gets made. Also, what better opportunity for employees to learn and grow than to watch and participate in such wrangling with the most pressing issues the company faces, and with the company's best minds and most qualified experts? This is a good way to show people what excellence is, what a good argument looks like, and what presenting a strong case requires. It's also a great way to discover who your most talented people are. In the culture deck, we wrote that one of the core qualities we looked for in those we hired and promoted was good judgment, defined, in essence, as the ability to make good decisions in ambiguous conditions, to dig deeply into the causes of problems, and to think strategically and articulate that thinking. Nothing could hone those skills better than this kind of open, vigorous debate. It also develops another of the core competencies we looked for, courage. People are emboldened to speak up when they see that their views will be heard and that they can really make a difference. Steve McClendon made another great point about the payoffs of open debate. Younger workers, those pesky millennials, whom so many managers find so challenging, take to this transparency and encouragement to ask questions like moths to a flame. Steve has moved on from Netflix and is now a co-founder of 60DB, a startup that streams personalized audio content, along with fellow former Netflixer John Cincuti and one-time host of NPR's Planet Money, Steve Henn. After leaving Netflix for other companies, Steve McClendon and John Cincuti both encountered upper management resistance to instituting the Netflix approach to questioning and open debate. So have other Netflixers who've moved on. I was actually called to consult to the CEO of a company that two former Netflixers had joined. He could not contain his irritation with their questioning, shouting at me, "These goddamn Netflix people want to know everything. It's none of their business." Steve was told that it's not good to argue in front of employees because it's like seeing your parents fight. But as he said, the Netflix culture lends itself to managing younger people much more than the old top-to-bottom style. He's been hiring lots of very junior people, as startups generally do, and he's found that they're eager to learn about the whole business and that the transparency really resonates with them. They're the wave of the future, and it's in every business leader's interest to figure out how to capitalize on that thirst for knowledge. I cautioned earlier about the limited value of formal employee development practices, such as conflict resolution and management classes. There is simply no comparison between the learning employees may take away from such courses and what they'll gain from participating in debates about business decisions. Ask anyone at your company whether they'd rather spend a day in a negotiation seminar or be able to ask, with impunity, a tough but fair question of a high-level manager at a big company meeting, or engage in a serious debate with their managers about the problem they've been asked to solve. I promise you, nobody but nobody is going to choose the seminar.
In brief, intense open debate over business decisions is thrilling for teams, and they will respond to the opportunity to engage in it by offering the very best of their analytical powers. Set terms of debate explicitly. People should formulate strong views and be prepared to back them up, and their arguments should be based primarily on facts, not conjecture. Instruct people to ask one another for explanations of their views and of the problems being debated, rather than making assumptions about these things. Be selfless in debating. That means being genuinely prepared to lose your case and openly admitting when you have. Actually orchestrate debates. You can have people formally present cases, maybe even have them get up on stage. Try having people argue the opposing side, poking holes in their own position. Formal debates, for which people prepare, often lead to breakthrough realizations. Beware of data masquerading as fact. Data is only as good as the conclusions it allows you to draw from it. People will be drawn to data that supports their biases. Hold your data up to rigorous scientific standards. Debates among smaller groups are often best because everyone feels freer to contribute, and it's more noticeable if they don't. Smaller groups also aren't as prone to groupthink as large groups are. Questions to consider. What problem is your team working on? Or what decision do you have coming up that you could stage a formal debate over? Having set the rule that people must state their case by marshaling facts, will you be prepared to concede that someone on your team makes a stronger case than yours? Are there members of your team who have become too fixed in their views about an issue and whom you could ask to take the perspective of the other side in a debate in front of your team? How well is your team set up to conduct formal testing of ideas and to obtain the data they need to draw strong conclusions? Are there any ways in which you could provide them with access to tools they may lack? How can you help your people to consider data beyond the information that is familiar to them and that they know how to interpret? What biases might members of your team and you have about which data you should be considering and your interpretations of it? Can you invite younger members of your team and perhaps of other teams to listen in on some of your debates? Could you or their direct manager coach them about how to participate themselves? Can you establish a regular forum for the presentation of arguments about key decisions and the best ways to solve problems your team is working on? And now, Chapter 5.
Chapter 5. Build the company now that you want to be then. Relentlessly focus on the future. Discussing the military's performance during the Iraq War, Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary at the time, famously said, "You go to war with the army you have, not the army you might want or wish to have at a later time." When I talk to managers about creating great teams, I tell them to approach the process in exactly the opposite way. You've got to hire now the team you wish to have in the future. Many leaders are great at seeing the future of product development and competition. They work hard to assess what the market demand will be and focus intensely on getting the product right and to market at the right time. But I find that they rarely look into the future in thinking about the team they'll need. They tend to focus on what their current team is achieving and how much more that team can do. If they do consider the future team, they generally think too much in terms of sheer numbers. We need 10 more engineers, or we've got to double our sales team. I recently got a call from a CEO of a company that now employs 150 people. He told me that it's going to grow to 300 and asked for my advice on getting to that number. It's a terrific company with a great product, and he told me that they've got good funding. I'm sure they're going to grow fast, but how they're going to grow is the question. I said, "That's a precise number. What's it based on?" He said that they were going to do twice as much work. I asked him if the new people would need to be doing the same kinds of work as the current staff, or if there might be new things to be done. Were they going to be launching a new product line, perhaps? If the teams were getting bigger, might he need more experienced managers? Did he want to keep teams smaller and maintain a flatter management structure? Did twice as much work mean they'd be reaching twice as many customers? If so, they'd have to significantly ramp up their customer service operation. But that might not mean hiring twice as many representatives. Maybe outsourcing to a specialty firm would be better. Then I asked the question that I found is the most thought-provoking for people in these consultations. He said he needed 150 new people, so I asked, "Are you sure you don't want 75 people who you pay twice as much because they have twice as much experience and can be higher performers?" Don't let hiring become a numbers game. If you're not constantly engaging in this exercise of looking ahead and envisioning the team you'll need, your team leaders are inevitably going to end up in a zero-sum competition for people. Here's how it typically went in my experience. A department head would call me and request approval to hire more people. And I'd say, well, let's make a business case and we'll discuss it. 10 minutes later, he'd be at my door saying, I don't think you understand. I need to talk to finance right now because we need 15 more people in my organization or we're just not going to make it. We need them, we're going to demand them, and we're going to get them right now. Okay, I'd say. Great, 15 more people at $150K a person. That's $1 million, which isn't in your budget. Just to be clear, we have no money tree, so we just can't harvest $1 million. We're going to have to get it from some other team. Are you asking for 10 people when you really only need 3? I can't tell you how many times I would go back to people's projections and find out that they had requested budget for 10 or 15% more hires than they ended up making. On the flip side, there's the problem of needing to hire people in too much of a rush because you're caught short. I'd have to say to hiring managers all the time, let's look at everybody you hired last year. You brought in 20 people in one quarter, and 5 of them were wrong for the job because you were in such a rush. Other times they would be very picky, but hadn't been creating a pipeline of potential hires, so we couldn't actually find good enough people in time, and actually had to postpone a project. Building the muscle to hire great people is a huge competitive advantage. Don't expect that your current team can be your team for tomorrow. Another mistake I've seen in building teams is assuming that the current employees will be able to grow into the responsibilities of the future. This is an especially acute problem for startups, because founders often feel a strong sense of loyalty to their early team. When I'm consulting to startup founders, I often have to tell them that many of their people aren't going to be competent in the new world order they're heading into as they scale. Usually they respond, but I like them, and they work hard, and they're really great. But the question is, can they do the job at scale? Are you going to need them to do tomorrow the same job they're doing now? What's your plan for them? Though the problem is more acute for startups, it happens in all kinds of companies, no matter how mature. With the fast pace of innovation in business today, no one can afford to make this mistake. I learned this lesson the hard way at Netflix. When we realized suddenly that within a year we would need the capacity to handle traffic equivalent to 1/3 of the U.S. internet bandwidth at that time, we had to immediately begin formulating a new plan to increase our data capacity. Right after that meeting, our head of product told me we needed to talk to IT immediately about getting set up with a cloud service. The IT guys essentially told us, "Why don't you go exec something and we'll build your cloud? We can do this." And I said, to be honest, if anyone could do it, it's you guys, but you can't do it in 9 months. Recognizing what the time constraint meant in terms of the team we needed was crucial. This became a really important debate in the company, and we quickly realized that we were going to need a data team significantly different than the one we had. But the beautiful thing was that I could say, okay, we've got 6 to 9 months to figure it out, and we did. We brought in people with fantastic experience in cloud operations and made a deal with Amazon Cloud Services rather than trying to build our own system. In my experience, one of the most important questions business leaders must regularly ask is, are we limited by the team we have not being the team we should have? Fast forward 6 months. Over time, I developed the following method for addressing this challenge, which I share with every company I consult with. Imagine, 6 months from now, you have the most amazing team you've ever assembled, and you're saying to yourself, wow, these guys are awesome. I can't believe what they're accomplishing. I say 6 months from now because that's about as far ahead as anyone can imagine in any business these days. First, write down what the team will be accomplishing 6 months from now that it's not accomplishing now. Use all the figures you want. You can say you're making X more dollars in revenue, the software is less buggy, you're closing the books in 4 days. Whatever it is, make a movie of it in your head. You're walking around the company watching this amazing team, accomplishing these amazing things. Maybe they're working on a prototype of a big new product. Maybe you're walking around your shiny new warehouse and people are zipping around, shipping twice as much product with the latest smart technology. Now, more important, think about how things are being done differently from the way they're currently done. Are people having more meetings or fewer? Are they having big, loud debates? Are they making decisions faster? Who's making these decisions? Who's not? Are more people working quietly, heads down, in their own little spaces? Or are they scribbling away like mad on whiteboards and groups all around? Are they working more cross-functionally? Doing more collaborative problem-solving? When I do this exercise with clients, I can see them actually close their eyes, and it's like I can see them walking around their company. And then I say, okay, in order for those different things to be happening, what would people need to know how to do? It might be something as simple as speaking up and having an argument and winning it. Or maybe being better at shutting up and listening. Or perhaps being more disciplined around communication. Maybe you need people who can launch a new product line of connected devices, or who know how to negotiate a certain kind of deal. What kind of skills and experience would it take for the team to operate in the way you're envisioning and accomplish the things you'll need to do in that future? This exercise often exposes problems in readiness regarding multiple changes to come, often changes that are rapidly closing in. Your team might lack the right hard skills, or you might lack people with the soft skills or the right experience to be great managers. An essential question is, do you have enough capacity builders? By which I mean people who know how to build a great team. Bringing in great capacity builders was one of my main missions at Netflix. If you do that, they will tell you what teams you need and build them for you when you need them. I think most business managers at most levels can pretty readily imagine the operational and managerial challenges involved in doubling in size, maybe even tripling. Those with an exceptional aptitude for understanding complexity can imagine even larger scale development of their businesses. But what if the size of your operation is going to increase tenfold in the next year, and you have a team of people who have only seen incremental growth? They probably won't know how to get there in time. You'll need people who can manage growth at a rate you're anticipating. Or what if you're evolving to a new business model? After asking yourself these questions, and only after, look at the team you have. This will help you see the skills and experience of your team more accurately. You'll be more cognizant of what they don't know how to do or don't do well, and you'll see where you need to bring in top performers in areas where you don't have them or don't have enough of them. The basic problem is that most people start with the team they have, thinking, we'll do more and we'll be amazing. The thing is, if you start with the team you have, sure, you can do more, but it won't necessarily be amazing. Instead, build the ideal team by starting with the vision down the road. Identify the problem you want to solve, the time frame in which you want to solve it, and the kinds of people who will be successful at that, and what they need to know how to do. And then ask yourself, what do we need to do to be ready and able, and whom do we need to bring in? You're building a team, not raising a family. As Reed and I worked on clarifying what kind of culture we had to build to enable the speed of change we needed, we realized it was important that everyone understand we were going to make sure our teams were constantly evolving. In discussing this, we decided to use the metaphor that the company was like a sports team, not a family. Just as great sports teams are constantly scouting for new players and culling others from their lineups, our team leaders would need to continually look for talent and reconfigure team makeup. We set the mandate that their decisions about whom to bring in and whom might have to go must be made purely on the basis of the performance their teams needed to produce in order for the company to succeed. If training people and grooming them to step into new roles was the best option, we fully backed that, and we helped managers to learn those skills. We also wanted them to carefully consider whether the best option might be bringing in new people who were high performers with the skills needed, even if that meant the current team members would have to move on from the company. Training well and spotting growth potential are vital skills for team leaders. I was always looking for hidden talents in people that would allow us to give them the opportunity to grow, and I encouraged all of our team leaders to do the same. Sometimes these gifts were obvious, but often they weren't, even to the employees themselves. Rochelle King was someone who I could see had an important talent that we really needed, that she herself didn't fully recognize. Her expertise was as a designer and a manager of designers, and we brought her in to manage that team when it really needed help. She whipped it into great shape incredibly fast, and I saw that she had the ability to take a dysfunctional team and make it highly well-functioning. So within 9 months of her joining, we asked her to lead 2 additional teams, one for enhanced metadata and the other for content operations. These were big teams, and she had no expertise in those areas. She said to me, "You understand I've never run teams like these before." But I was confident that she would step up and do a great job, and she did. Still, we were also both aware that her taking the job was a risk, and we were honest about it. When I spoke with Eric Coulson, he recalled Reed offering him a big new job managing the general data team, which Eric turned down 3 times before he finally accepted it. He had been writing algorithms to improve our operations system, and he had been killing it. This job was a whole different ball game. He'd be managing a large company-wide team reporting directly to Reed. He didn't think he was ready for it. But Reed was pretty convinced Eric could be great in the role. Eric thrived. Promoting people gives them opportunities to stretch and take on new roles. It can be ideal, but it's not always the best option. We told our team leaders that it was important to be realistic about what sort of performance improvement people were capable of, and whether that could be achieved in the time needed. We had a rule of thumb for whether to promote from within or bring in a top performer from the outside. Did the job to be done require expertise that no one inside had? Or was the work in an area that we ourselves were at the forefront of innovating? With cloud services, there was better expertise outside, so it was much more effective for us to bring people in. With developing data algorithms, we were at the forefront of innovation and saw that in Eric, we had top-rate talent inside. With other roles, if we hadn't brought in talent from the outside, we almost surely would have stumbled. Sometimes promoting is not the right solution. When I consult to company leaders and their team managers, probably the most difficult advice for them to accept is they don't owe their people anything more than ensuring the company is making a great product that serves the customers well and on time. They don't owe people the chance to take on a role they're not prepared for and don't have the talents for. That they don't owe them a different job created to reward them for their service. And they certainly don't owe them holding the company back from making the personnel changes needed to thrive. I know this may sound harsh, because the notion that a company makes special investments in developing people, providing paths for promotions, and strive for high employee retention rates are so deeply ingrained. But I've come to believe such thinking is outmoded and isn't even the best approach for the employees. It often leads to people becoming stuck in jobs they don't really want, or aren't doing as well as they want to, or as you need them to, rather than scouring the job landscape for better opportunities. Giving people promotions and coaching them in new roles can be both enormously satisfying for team leaders and great for performance. But promoting and developing people are often simply not the best things for team performance. Managers should not be expected to be career planners. In today's fast-moving business environment, trying to play that role can be dangerous. At Netflix, when we were interviewing people, we told them straight out that we were not a career management company, that we believe people's careers were theirs to manage, and while there may be lots of opportunity for them to advance at the company, we wouldn't be designing opportunities for them. So often, companies give people half a job that needs to be done because the person can't do the whole job. I realized that we just couldn't afford to do that. We needed people who could do the whole job. We were also determined not to make the incredibly common mistake of promoting into management roles strong performers who are simply not well suited to managing. In some periods of a company's growth, there are lots of opportunities for current employees to be promoted into new roles. But often there are simply no legitimate spots for people, even very good people, to move up to. When there were openings at Netflix that we might have promoted people into, in many instances we knew the much better option was to bring in somebody who already had been a top performer in the job we needed done. If people were eager to take on responsibilities we couldn't give them, or to do work that wasn't a priority for us, we encouraged them to look for those opportunities elsewhere. We also suggested that our employees interview elsewhere regularly, so they could get a gauge of the market opportunities. This also allowed us to get a better understanding of how sought after they were and what we should be paying them. The advantages of more fluid team building flow both ways. I believe the best advice for all working people today is to stay limber, to keep learning new skills and considering new opportunities, regularly taking on new challenges so that work stays fresh and stretches them. At Netflix, we encouraged people to take charge of their own growth, availing themselves of the rich opportunities we afforded them to learn from stellar colleagues and managers, and making their own way, whether that meant rising within the company or seizing a great opportunity elsewhere. Put yourself in a startup founder's shoes. I appreciate that embracing this perspective can be a struggle, and for good reason. We've been taught to think so differently about our responsibilities to our employees. I see this most intensely with the startup founders I advise. They almost always have to face the hard truth that the kinds of people and the ways of working they needed in the early phase of developing their products and finding a market are very different from the people and talents that will allow their companies to scale. In the beginning, they need the smartest people that they can afford to pay, who want to work very hard and who believe in the vision. The belief part is crucial because all startups are crazy ideas. If they were logical, somebody else would already be doing them. Initial startup success requires making all kinds of mistakes and being willing to keep working incredibly hard, trying all sorts of things, really pounding at it until you have a product that's viable and a market that's receptive. The answers are unknown, and most of the work is improvisational. Then, suddenly, growth starts to take off, and the problems are not so much ones solved by trial and error as ones requiring experience. They're problems of scale and complexity. And the thing about scale and complexity is sometimes you get lucky, and some of those early people can cope with the changes and develop the skills they needed, but in many cases they can't or don't want to. Virtually every company is contending with the same challenge all the time to some degree. The challenge of recognizing that change has to happen and new people will be needed to bring it about. If this perspective is uncomfortable for you, ask yourself, what would be the right thing for a startup founder to do in the face of this challenge? Why should that answer be any different for you? Nostalgia is an early warning sign. One reason Reed and I started using the team not family metaphor was that the company kept changing. We saw that nostalgia for the good old scrappy days was a powerful form of resistance. The nostalgia was totally understandable. I had it too. The early days of Netflix were a blast. We were so informal that we had company meetings around a picnic table in the parking lot, and we were a brash upstart in a cool business. We loved going to the Sundance Film Festival and presenting edgy movies by up-and-coming directors. I remember fondly the glee with which Ted Sarandos told me one year that he'd snagged the director's cut of a much buzzed about and quite graphic black comedy for the screening, titled Spun. The movie was set in the meth culture of Eugene, Oregon, and depicted the perils of addiction with brutal honesty. Being the edgy appreciators of such boundary-pushing films was in the company's DNA and was the source of pride for many of us. When we made the move to streaming, all of a sudden we were going to reinvent television. So much for the ultra-hip indie film company, many thought, and some people weren't at all happy about it. Of course, as Netflix has moved into original content creation, it's become strikingly clear that going into television didn't expunge the edgy soul at all. Shows like Orange is the New Black and The Santa Clarita Diet, about a suburban housewife who's a human flesh-eating zombie, have demonstrated the company still loves pushing the envelope. An appreciation of the core elements of the company's early success is so important, and it can be retained as companies adapt and grow. But nostalgia that inspires resistance to change will fuel discontent and often undermine growth. In the early days of Netflix, an engineer who had been there from early on said to me, "You know, it's not like it used to be, when we all used to hang around the parking lot and everyone contributed to the product. Now people don't know each other's names. It's getting really big, and I just don't think management understands that things have changed." I was management, of course, so I assured him that we were very much aware. Because he had shared the thought with me several times, and I could see how upsetting the changes were for him, I then asked him, "Do you know why things are changing?" And he responded, "Why?" And I said, "Because we're successful. Do you know what we want to be someday? We want to be a global corporation." That's a shocking term to a hardcore startup guy. Sometimes people who were just right for an organization at a certain point and loved working for it are best off moving to a new organization with a similar set of challenges and environment. I told this engineer, "It's okay. You don't have to be part of it. You may be most happy in a 50-person organization. Maybe that's where you find your greatest joy." Taking this approach to team building meant that at Netflix, I had to develop a new approach to hiring, so we could have the strong talent pipeline we needed. We had to build organization-wide capacity for excellent hiring, and we did.
In brief, to stay agile and move at the speed of change, hire the people you need for the future now. On a regular basis, take the time to envision what your business must look like 6 months from now in order to be high-performing. Make a movie of it in your head, imagining how people are working and the tools and skills they have. Then start immediately making the changes necessary to create that future. More people will not necessarily do more work or better work. It's often better to have fewer people with more skills who are all high-performers. Successful sports teams are the best model for managers